My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pahl and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of the following words? We begin with Dennis Norden. Dennis, your word is detritus, D-E-T-R-I-T-U-S, detritus.
That is great. I don't know how many years we've been doing this program. That's the first word I've ever had in this round that I've actually used. I actually did it because we were flooded. And after it's all gone down, everything's so smelly. And you have to get it carted away. And the underfelt all goes stinky and soft, you know. And you have to have a special refuse collection to have it carted away. And you have to pay the council. And I put in the insurance for it. And they said, didn't ask for it on your policy. Noah would have been the only one far seeing enough to put in for refuse collection. But anyway, detritus means the muck left behind by a flood, and it cost an extra £2 on the council to have it carted away.
You're absolutely right, Dennis, but it doesn't only happen to Dennis Norden. It can happen to whole stretches of country. It means what's been eroded or washed away from something which was otherwise solid, like rock. But he's quite right. It's usually associated with what's been washed down by water or by flood.
It can mean lovely leaf mould, if I might say so, for the garden.
Yes, too, I'm sorry, that's the other bit. That's the biological sense, which means the disintegrating remains of plants and animals. And that's compost, I suppose, isn't it, Anne?
I would think. Mm. Or what's been sort of left behind when 4 million years of trees have left their leaves.
When you're served it up in a macrobiotic restaurant, you then suffer from detritus.
Nearly right, but not quite. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, your word is simony, S-I-M-O-N-Y.
Well, that's a kind of... that's something to do with the church.
Yes.
And it's not quite right, is it?
It wasn't regarded as very
no,
right,
not quite
no.
right.
St. Peter didn't think so.
It's a kind of corruption.
Yes.
Church corruption, getting money for nothing.
Yes, the traffic in buying ecclesiastical advantages, a preferment or a benefice or extra money, and it comes from Simon Magus in the Acts of the Apostles, who was rebuked by St. Peter because he offered the apostles money to receive the gift of laying on of hands. That was the first example of simony. 2 marks.
There was a book about it called The Peter Principle.
I saw that today, yes. I can't quite see the connection, Frank.
Don't push it.
Well, it's your turn, Frank. Your word is carapace.
Carapace. There is a tide in the affairs of man which, when it recedes, leaves a mess in the brain. And that is carapace. Because I have no idea what it means. No idea.
I think your partner might be a slightest
assistant. Is it Greek?
Well, it's a kind of shell, dear.
It's a shell, dear.
Yes, a tortoise has a carapace, I think, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely
yes.
right.
Has yes. it?
Yes, dear. Yes.
Tortoises have so little. I know. In this life, it's very warming to know that they have
carapace.
It's a tortoise possession, a tortoise.
Yes. It's a shell, it's a kind of outer covering, okay. Not a hard.
A tortoise's overcoat. Yeah.
That's it. 2 marks. It can also happen to turtles and to crabs and to lobsters and to some other crustaceans, but it is the upper shell of those animals. It comes from a Spanish word called carapacho.
Two marks. Do woodlice have it?
Moderately.
I rest my case with Frank Muir. I think I wouldn't know whether that's a carapace or not. Anne Scott James, now your word's a short one. Cud. C-U-D.
Well, chewing the cud, I mean, it's that sort of Something of a cakey mixture, which cows eat. Cow cake. And chewing the cud, as used in P.G. Woodhouse, for instance, would mean you were sort of chatting it up with Jeeves, wouldn't it? I was chewing the cud with Jeeves yesterday.
Yes, that's figuratively, but where would the cow keep this?
In its manger, definitely. It would be poured out of a bag for it to eat.
I hope not. It would be very regrettable. And
chewing the cud?
It would smell rather a lot if it did have it in its manger.
Oh, dear. Oh, oh dear, dear. Further on there.
Yeah. What do you think?
I don't know. Is it something to do with this peculiar digestive system
of
cows? Well, I don't know anything about that. I only know.
Oh, I know. They swallow it all and munch away inside.
Yes. But that's why I said where. Can you locate it?
Within the cow's belly.
Which one?
Ah.
Oh. Well,
either the upper or the lower.
Yes. Yes, go on.
Come on,
all right, one and a half. You've got quite a long way there. A cow is a ruminant, and it has this rather curious habit. No matter what the food is, which the food to start with is not the cud, it goes into its first stomach, and then it gets it back very cleverly from its first stomach and chews it again and again. Once it got past that first stomach into the second, third, or fourth, it can't get it back.
And oh, it's good.
See,
it's an old English word which is much the same as glue, which gives you an idea of what cud is like.
When the penny drops and you can't...
That's right. No, one and a half. Well, for those who like to guess ahead at the stories, what, Dennis, will be your quotation for later in the programme?
My quotation is there honey still for tea?
Good.
From Grantchester.
And yours, Frank?
Mine is Truth is Stranger Than Fiction.
Well?
Which was Byron in Don Juan.
Well, we wait for those till the last round. Round two is about craftsmen's necessaries. For two marks, what's the craft of the craftsman who uses the following? That is, I want to know the craft, and the craftsman will follow from there. Dennis Norton. Here is this group. Oak tree branches, a clamp, and a loo, L-O-O.
You know, they sound like sort of degrees of desperation. you only can't find a loo using oak tree branches. As a very last resort, use a clamp.
It's a bit more rural than that.
Is it? I remember when we did French, we always used to do those interminably boring stories about charbonnier.
That's right.
Or charcoal burner.
Absolutely right. You've got that.
But do they do it over here, charcoal burner?
Yes, they do, still, but not quite so often. Oak makes the best charcoal. The clamp is the funny dome-shaped fire where you piled it up, where the wood was sort of toasted into charcoal. And a loo was a canvas screen, as you won't be surprised to hear, that you place on the windward side of the clamp. It regulates the draft. Dennis Bow, a hot chisel, bellows, and a halfpenny snub-end scroll.
Bookbinding.
No, it's hotter than that.
Something with blacksmith.
Yes.
Something to do with a blacksmith.
Bellows, hot chisel.
A blacksmith.
Yes. A blacksmith. Mm. It'll do. Have two marks. I don't need to explain the hot chisel or the bellows. A halfpenny snub-end scroll, you've got to believe this one. It's a small, squarish block of iron with a one-inch groove on its side that's used for finishing wrought iron with a rounded tip. Two marks.
Could he?
Yeah. Frank goes down. Frank, a Jarvis, a spokeshave, and a fellow, but F-E-L-L-O-E.
Well, a spoke shave is used for shaving spokes.
Yes, you're dead right.
It's a nice tool, a spoke shave. Is it making wheels?
It is, entirely.
Jarvis is the name of the chap who pumps the bellows.
Jarvis is a hollow-bladed plane used for rounding the contours of a spoke in the wheel.
Ah.
And a fellow is a bit of the outer circle or circumference of the wheel. You get your two marks. And Scott James, an eaves hook, a reed holder, and a wibble. W-E-B-B-L-E, Wibble.
Could this be anything to do with thatching?
Absolutely right.
Oh, it is.
The eaves hook is a kind of knife shaped like a sickle, used for trimming the thatch. It looks neat. Wibble was a barred thrashing frame against which the newly cut weeds are beaten so as to remove the ears. 2 marks. Well, now we have a dip into a collection of verse very well known to our grandfathers, and in some cases our fathers. That is Palgrave's Golden Treasury. For 2 marks, can you complete the verse or stanza from a should-be familiar poem which begins with this line? And Ennis Norton, I must go down to the seas again.
To the lonely sea and the sky, and all I want is a tall ship and a star to steer her by. And then the rhythm changes rather nicely there, and with the sail winds shaking and the bum, 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 bum. It goes into a rather syncopated rhythm.
It goes into dactyls, I think, yes. That's absolutely right. And do you remember who wrote it? I didn't ask that.
Maysfield.
Yes.
Sea Fever.
Quite right.
Favourite song.
Yes. 2 marks. Clotus Power, say not the struggle, naught availeth.
Oh, dear. Really?
Another stanza starts, and not by eastern windows
only.
Well,
it's only something, but flooding in. It's about being very hopeful.
Mm-hmm. When daylight comes in the light. Mm. In front the sun climbs slow, how slowly.
No, that's not it, Jack.
Westward.
No.
The land is bright. That's the two stanzas away from what I want from you.
The poem is CCCLV11. Deny that.
No, you're not going to get it. I'm sorry, I can't give you any marks. It's Arthur Hugh Clough.
Oh.
Say not the struggle, nor availeth. The labour and the wounds are vain. The enemy faints not, nor faileth. And as things have been, things remain. It ends optimistically.
Oh.
No marks.
Not to know that, is it?
Frank Muir, yours is this. The splendour falls on castle walls.
It does not fall on Bothy. I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls. It must have been the coffee. It reeks of Tennyson.
Tennyson it is.
Blow, bugles blow, I think.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
It is. Oh.
And also the horns of Elfland faintly blowing.
So yes. The wild cataract.
Yes, you're getting
leaps in glory.
Yes, that's it.
Blow, bugles blow.
Yes, that'll do. 1.5 we'll give you for this.
Blow, bugles blow.
Tennyson.
It is, yes.
Tennyson the Princess. The splendour falls on castle walls and snowy summits,
olden story.
The long light shakes across the lakes. And the wild cataract leaps in glory. And then you get a lot of bugles going on, which I won't go on repeating. 1.5. And now, Anne Scott James. Lives of great men all remind us.
Lives of great men all what?
Remind us.
This is the one this is the one that you're... When you had an autograph book, when you're about 12, and you asked your teacher to write in it, this was the corny little inspirational verse... Lives of great men all remind us. Something about we can make our lives sublime.
Yes.
Departing, we can leave behind us footprints in the sands of time.
Yeah, fair enough.
Oh,
yeah. And remember the... Longfellow. Yes. Oh, you'll get your two. Just get it quite accurate.
Thank you, Norton.
Thank you, Mrs. Henley. When I was a mixed infant.
The lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Longfellow's poem called A Psalm of Life. Well, now we come to the last round and Dennis and Frank's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Dennis, your quotation, is the honey still for tea?
Well, that line, so evocative of English country life, always takes me back to the time when, as a very small, very bewildered, rather frightened little boy, I was evacuated to the village of Chiselbury. Now, Chiselbury, nestling as it does in a fold of the Mendip Hills, represents, even to this day, the very heartbeat of the true England. One church, one pub, one everything shop, one cricket green...
one Chinese takeaway. But back in those days, I was the very first evacuee they had seen, due to the fact that, because I think of some official mix-up, it was only 1935. Nevertheless, these gentle-souled country folk took me immediately to their hearts. My hosts, Mr. and Mrs. Archer, were kindness itself, and for me, a child of the pavements, this new world of the countryside was a paradise that every day revealed new wonders. Oh, look, Mr. Archer, I would say as I bounded along by his side, is that a hedge warbler? Nay, lad, he'd reply, that's a cow. For he was he was wise in country wisdom. His trade being that ancient and fast disappearing rural craft, wood carving. For hours he would work away with his knife, his chisel, and his saw, fashioning a panelled door or a donkey cart or an outside privy. And as the wood chips flew, I would sit fascinated. Sometimes I'd venture a question like, wouldn't it be better if you got out of bed to do that? But for answer, he would just chuckle, and then he'd take his knife and he'd whittle something, especially for me, a wooden spoon or a catapult, pair of socks, a evening dress tie. There was nothing that he couldn't whittle out of an old piece of wood. His wife, the good and ever-smiling Mrs. Archer, whose cowslip stew I can still taste when the wind is in the west, she kept the village's everything shop, and when I call it an everything shop, that is exactly what she sold. Bread, cream, groceries, paraffin, sweets, overcoats, ploughs, pianos, theatre tickets, diving suit, manure, sports cars, all the livelong day she'd be up and down her ladder fetching something off a shelf. Because she also sold shelves and ladders. And the third member of the household was Mr. and Mrs. Archer's 16-year-old daughter, Annie. A strange, fey girl with a great love of nature's creatures and a 40-inch bust. So shy was she about this last attribute, she spent much of her time taking solitary walks in the woods, her only companion, her dog, an elderly Labrador with a dank, matted appearance, like D.H. Lawrence. And occasionally she'd allow me to accompany her, and I'd notice how sometimes she'd stand motionless for hours, simply observing the ways of the furred and feathered creatures who were her friends. Look, she would say, a stoat have passed this way. How can you tell? I would marvel. Well, look what he done on your shoe, he would say. But these excursions grew more and more infrequent, and such was Annie's self-consciousness about her configuration, they ceased altogether when one day, having washed her brassiere, she hung it on a tree to dry, and two little birds built a nest in it. What's more, if I were to tell you what species of birds they were, you would hardly credit the coincidence. But that was, as the poet Jerome Kern says, long ago and far away. I wonder sometimes what the Archers are doing today. Does Mr. Archer still whittle in his bed? Is
Mrs. Archer still nipping up and down her ladder for a crepe bandage or a two-stroke motorbike. And even more fascinating, and in the words of another poet, is there Annie still 40?
Well, I never knew that Dennis Norton knew where the country was. But we go on to Frank Muir and his quotation, "Truth is stranger than fiction."
I was reminded the other day of a quotation which the Venerable Bede had written in the answered correspondence bit of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. He's applying to some query from one of his brethren, and he said, "We are all creatures of habit." And indeed, this is terribly true, and it's surprising, really, when one reflects how much one is a slave to habit. I remember once, a few weeks ago, my wife was on duty in one of her things, which meant that she might be rung up at any time of the night. So we changed places in bed. And I, for 26 years, have slept on the east side of the bed, facing Chertsey. And my wife has slept on the west side of the bed facing Egham. And we switched over. And it was absolutely frightening after 26 years. I dozed off fitfully and suddenly wanted a drink of water and stretched out my hand and punched her really rather nastily on the chin bone. And I dozed off again and then felt cold. And, as was my habit, tried to establish contact with her and borrow a bit of warmth and fell out of bed. It was absolutely... And in the morning, this sort of alien woman beside me on the wrong side with the sort of shapes and curves and all wrong. You know. But the whole thing was brought home to me even more how one is not only a creature to habit, but you can pick up habits very quickly and you can change them. And you can absorb new habits really much more quickly than you think. This was happened earlier this year in Corsica, where my wife and I had gone for 3 weeks holiday. And on the second night, I had dental trouble. Now, what happens is there's a unused bottle of wine, you see, is on the draining board. And I always say, well, just have a walk round and see all the windows are shut and the shutters are, you see, and then creep into the kitchen in the dark. One pace in, two left in the dark, stretch out the hand, there's the bottle, swing it up very sharply to the lips so that you don't get a gluck, gluck, gluck sound, and I can hoist in a good cupful and put it back very gently and then walk through into the bedroom and say, everything locked up, fine, you see. But habit, you see, had got me that action off absolutely quickly. But this year, for some reason, there was a litre bottle. Now, a litre bottle is about two-thirds of an inch taller than an ordinary bottle. And I crept in, one pace forward, two paces left, reach, upward sweep, and crash. I'd lost a tooth. It was one of those which is, I don't know what they call crowned, isn't it? Which is a kind of falsie, which is pegged to another. And it fell into the bottle, and I had a terrible time getting it. I had to drink the bottle to get it out. And I had this terrible. Well, I tried to make do with it, and sibilance was rather awful, any sort of word. Very sunny this morning. And then I discovered, this is what I think, when you get the habit of having this gap in your teeth, it suddenly becomes rather nice. I found that when I was eating lettuce, I could lodge with my tongue a little slip of the lettuce and then blow it out through the gap like a little green pennant. And if I blew it, would flutter and go... And when I was having a shower, I discovered I could fill my mouth with water and get a tremendous jet of water which landed in the loo. Which was 2.5 meters away. That's 7 foot 6 in old money. But better than that, the little stub thing of tooth that was left was sort of rough. And when my tongue went against it, it had a sort of friction effect. And this became a friend. And for the whole of the 3 weeks, before I went to sleep, I used to sort of run my tongue over this. And it was a sort of friend inside one's mouth. And when I woke up in the morning, I'd feel the little friction thing. The tongue used to tremble. And it was lovely. And I got to love my little gap. And then we came home, and I went to a Harley Street chap and got the tooth done in properly. And it was terrible. Suddenly, where my lovely, friendly gap was, there was this enormous, great, smooth lump of alien substance. So really, it just shows that Lord Byron was right in Don Juan, that after you've got used to a gap, tooth is stranger than friction.
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the story contest, and he and Dilys Powell also win this entire edition of My Word.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dilys Powell, Dennis Norton, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.